You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Ross Tucker, our good buddy, the former NFL offensive lineman, host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. And you can check out the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. Also a game analyst for the Eagles in their preseason. Also does some college football and NFL for CBS in Westwood One. Ross joins us now. How would you answer that? Most iconic NFL team in history is?
You know, for me, it's probably either the Packers or the Steelers. And it was interesting, Dan, hearing you guys talk about it. You know what it really is? Like, for all of us, our age group, it's whoever was featured the most on NFL films from the 60s and 70s. Yeah. You know, like, that is what's iconic. I can just picture Vince Lombardi, you know, and all those videos. Come on, guys, let's go. The Green Bay power sweep. Or the videos of, like, Lynn Swann being in the air for 48 seconds catching passes in Super Bowls. I think it's hard for any other team to be more iconic than the teams that were so revered and featured on those NFL films videos from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it's like they had a head start because they were successful at a time when we didn't get to watch all of the games. Maybe you got to see your team featured with Howard Cosell on Monday Night Football with the 3-minute highlights. But I would probably, I don't think there's a wrong answer if it's the Cowboys, Steelers, Packers, or Raiders. It just depends on, you know, what was your fandom growing up, and was it based off your dad or your grandfather? Because that's usually where it starts. If you're a fan of that team now and you're in your 30s, chances are it was based off of who your dad was rooting for. How important is preseason?
Well, I think to the teams themselves, I think we saw last year, probably not all that important. To the players that are playing tonight, it's everything. I mean, I had some guy on Twitter hit me up at Ross Tucker NFL and say preseason doesn't mean you know what. And I just replied back to him, Dan, you know, there's 90-man rosters, right? We won't see hardly any starters tonight. So there's at least 50 guys playing tonight, okay, that were two-time All-State, two-time All-Conference in college, maybe the best athlete to ever come from their hometown, that the 2.5, 3 quarters they play tonight, it's the most important game of their lives. I'm talking about guys 50 to 90 on the roster, certainly 65 to 90 on each roster. It's the most important game of their life. So if you don't care about that, that's fine. That doesn't bother me. I get it. You just want the starters. You just want the games that count. That's fine. But number one, to those guys, it means everything. And number two, just don't tell me you're the biggest fan ever. Like, I always laugh when people are like, I'm a diehard Cowboys fan. I'm the biggest fan ever. But they don't watch the preseason. Like, there are a lot of fans out there. They watch every second of the preseason because they care about the third string tight end and the O-line depth. And they want to know who the fourth corner will be. And it's totally acceptable if you don't feel that way. Just do me a favor. Don't call yourself the biggest fan ever.
How do you make a roster during preseason if you're a borderline player?
Two things. Number one is, you first of all, it starts by doing something to stand out. You know, there's 90 guys now. There's only 80 guys, Dan, when I was playing. But with 90 guys, especially if you're one of these bottom of the roster undrafted guys, you must do something unique or different to stand out. And mine was taking the aggression to another level, right? Like, having the coaches have to tell me to calm down. That's one way. They love that. You know, like Joe Judge has all the Giants players running and doing push-ups. Meanwhile, the next day he's like, I got to be honest, that really turned me on. I really like that. They all act like they don't like fights, Dan. They're all full of it, okay? If you're a football coach, it's because at one point you loved football and you played it, which means you loved the physical part of it, which means you love that. You love that. I mean, Dan Campbell at least admits it. I love Dan Campbell. Dan Campbell's like, oh, that was amazing. Like, at least he says it. So number one, you have to stand out in some way. And then number two, the coaches have to trust you. They have to trust you, which means you cannot mess up mentally. Honestly, Dan, I wasn't that physically gifted, But I never messed up mentally. I always did what the coaches wanted me to do. I blocked the right guy the way they wanted me to block him. And then I tried to kill the guy to the best of my ability. And that's like the only reason I made it with Schottenheimer as a rookie and then stuck around for a while.
But I guess you get cut then if you do mess up something mentally. If you're a lineman, I'm guessing.
Yeah, any position, Dan. It is the single biggest reason why guys don't make it. I think NFL football is way more complicated, or at least detailed, than people realize. I can't tell you. I mean, I've seen guys that bench press 600 pounds. They just couldn't figure it out. I've seen guys that were way more talented than me. They didn't know who to block, when the defense would change their alignment. And honestly, some of the guys, Dan, I actually felt bad for. There was a kid I remember. He was really gifted. He spent every second, Dan, studying the playbook. And if you would ask him, he would know it. You'd say, well, what happens if they do this? What happens if they do that? But then when he actually got out there, Dan, and they're flying around, and it happens in a split second, it's a different type of intelligence. And some guys, it comes very naturally for, and other guys really struggle with it. And if you really struggle with the football IQ, the FBI, if you will, football intelligence, you're going to have a really tough time sticking around the NFL as a player.
More intriguing team this season, the Steelers or the Cowboys?
They're both pretty intriguing. I'm going to say Steelers because of what happened last year, because of a totally new offensive line, and because of Big Ben. I mean, I go on in Pittsburgh radio. I live in central Pennsylvania. There were a lot of people in Pittsburgh, including, you know, radio guys and fans. They wanted the team to move on for Big Ben. Yeah. They wanted to turn the page. They thought Big Ben, and think that Big Ben's washed up. They wanted to see what Mason Rudolph could do in his last year under contract, and or turn the page and get the next. I thought they were nuts. I think the Steelers did the right thing, giving Ben one last chance, especially when you have a roster with Cam Hayward and Minka Fitzpatrick and TJ Watt and these guys. I think that those guys and Ben have earned the right to make one more run at this thing. I mean, they were 11-0 last year. I thought they were the best team in the NFL until the wheels came off.
How many legitimate Super Bowl contenders do you think we have this year?
Maybe six.
So I Chiefs, mean, Buccaneers.
So in the NFC, maybe three. Tampa,
Rams,
Green Bay, and maybe the Rams. I don't see the Niners or the Seahawks getting there. So in the NFC, I'm saying maybe three, and I think even the Rams are dubious. In the AFC, it's obviously Kansas City. I would say Buffalo, Cleveland, nobody in the AFC South, nobody else AFC West. I don't think Baltimore is legit. I'm saying six total. I'm saying the six I just gave you, three in each conference.
And I wonder if our expectations are a little high on the Rams, because as soon as they got Matthew Stafford, I said, I don't know what the odds are, but that's my MVP pick. And then all of a sudden, I started to see where there were a lot of people who thought, oh, the Rams, they could go to the Super Bowl, and Matthew Stafford could be the MVP. Like, Peter King was gushing that Matthew Stafford's going to throw for 6,000 yards. I don't know. Are our expectation level a little too high for the Rams?
I think it is. Look, I think Matthew Stafford is better than Jared Goff. But I don't think it's as pronounced as everybody else seems to think. I mean, most of these years, if you looked at quarterback rankings, Stafford was probably somewhere between 10 and 15. And Goff might have been between 15 and 20. I don't know. I mean, how much of a difference is that, Dan? Is that a 2 or 3 win difference? Is that Super Bowl or not? I don't know. I mean, and by the way, when they get Stafford, they lose John Johnson and Troy Hill. Both those guys went to Cleveland. So they lost two of the guys that were really good in their secondary. I mean, you know, they gained Stafford, but they lost some other guys. And I'm just fascinated by them. I mean, they have no first-round picks forever. They have no middle class. They have elite guys and guys making the minimum, and it's kind of working for him. We'll see if it works this year.
What, McLovin? You're rolling your eyes back there at Ross Tucker.
Well, Stafford was ranked 10 to 15 when he was with the Lions. Now that he's with Sean McVay and the Rams, don't you think he'll possibly move up that ranking?
I mean, he might. That's certainly what they're counting on. I guess what I would say about the Sean McVay thing always makes me laugh. He's obviously a good coach, right? But you ever notice how for 4 years, every time the Rams scored a bunch of points, it was Sean McVay. Oh, my gosh. I sound like Paulie doing my impersonation right there. Sean McVay. Oh, my gosh. He's the greatest coach of all time.
He's got the best hair.
He's a genius.
He's got a great house.
And by the way, whenever the Rams stunk, it was, or they didn't do anything on offense, Jared Goff stinks. It's all Jared Goff's fault. You can't have it both ways, Dan. You can't. Everything positive can't be McVay, and everything negative is Goff. Like, let's split up both of them a little bit.
Yeah, but that happens with Kyle Shanahan. When that offense is clicking, that's Kyle Shanahan's offense. But when it's not, that Jimmy Garoppolo can't play.
It's a great point. they both deserve a slice of the success and futility pie. I agree.
It's great to talk to you. And what are you benching right now?
Not enough. By the way, how about this? Last Friday on the beach, okay, I did an hour walk on the beach, and every 5 minutes I did 20 push-ups. So I had done 160 push-ups, and then at the end I wanted to, like, rep out. I'm 256 pounds. I did 42 push-ups. I did my age in push-ups after doing 160. So I don't max out, but that's my new thing. Until I die, I want to be able to do my age in push-ups. Going to get tough in my 70s, certainly my 80s, but I want to try to do my age in push-ups.
Who's the strongest guy that you were ever around? Either teammate, played against?
Well, I was teammates with Larry Allen, who was ridiculously strong. I think he benched like 700 pounds. But there was a guy, Chris Valerial, who I played with in Buffalo. He's actually the head coach at St. Francis, which is an FCS school. Paulie probably watches all their games live out in Western PA. I saw him. They drafted a kid. Dan, this is a true story. We drafted a kid out of Vanderbilt that benched 600 pounds. And so there was a discussion on the Bills, who's the strongest guy? So we go to Valerial, who's like in his eighth year, and we're like, you know what you got to do, right? Like, I mean, he's like 32 years old. We're like, you know, he's like, yeah, I know. He puts 495 on the incline bench and reps it out for 10, gets off the bench and like stares at the Vanderbilt rookie. Just like, and we were like, yeah, it was awesome. It was meatheadness at its finest.
And you're the president and a member.
Proud member.
Yes, of course.
I'm surprised we're not doing this on a meat Friday. Every Friday I see that tweet and I get so jealous.
It's great to talk to you. We'll check in with you during the season, Ross. Thank you.
All right. See you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app. Babe Laufenberg, 26 years working the Cowboys Radio Network as an analyst, the former NFL quarterback, back on the show. Babe, good morning. How are you?
Dan, I'm doing great. And very quickly, you know, you've got your biggest fan and my nephew, Kyle, who lives in Orange County and California and never misses a show. And he has eaten dinner with Troy Aikman, with Daryl Johnston, with Jason Garrett. It means nothing to him. But well, this means everything to him. No credibility for any of that, but all of a sudden, oh, you go on, Dan.
Well, I'm glad to help your street cred there, Babe.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
All right. Paulie, give the poll question to Babe.
Which team is more likely to miss the playoffs, the Steelers or the Cowboys?
To miss the playoffs. That's a heck of a question there. I'm going to say the Steelers, only because of the division they play in. where Cleveland is obviously no longer a win. Cincinnati should be better with Joe Burrow. And then you got Baltimore, who's always good. And they have literally the most difficult schedule in the NFL this year, if you base it, which is all we can do, on last year's teams. And as we all know, the NFC East is so weak. And I think the Cowboys' offense is going to be good enough to carry them. So I'm going to say if one of them misses, it would be Pittsburgh, but I wouldn't bet on that.
What would the fallout be if Dallas doesn't make the playoffs?
Yeah, I was listening to the question about McCarthy's job security, and you're exactly right. The Cowboys owner, he's actually pretty loyal to his coaches, and he will always tell you that one of his biggest regrets is firing Chan Gailey after 2 years, and Chan Gailey actually made the playoffs. I think it all depends on how they miss the playoffs. Of course, we're in a 17-game schedule now. If they're 10-7 and for whatever reason that isn't good enough to get you in, or they have an inordinate amount of injuries like they did last year again, I think you always have to factor in, are you playing without your quarterback? I think all those things factor in. But, you know, there's no question they did not sign Mike McCarthy up for a 6-10 season last year.
When did things go sideways or south with Jerry Jones and Jimmy Johnson?
Wow. You know, I always felt like the spotlight is so big in Dallas, and it really is, as you well know. This isn't a small market team. They are the most visible team, maybe in all of sports. And so the spotlight is big. So there's plenty of spotlight to go on Jimmy, on the Cowboys owner, on Troy, on Emmett, on Michael, on Dion. That spotlight was so big. So that's the thing that always surprised me. But I think the other thing too, Dan, is when they first united in 1989 and Jerry hired Jimmy to be his head coach, the whole narrative was these guys were best friends in college. They roomed together. They went out together. And then when the breakup came, it was, well, they only roomed together because it was alphabetical, Jones and Johnson. So 1 minute, again, they were best friends, and the next minute they just happened to be thrown in the same room. But I couldn't tell you exactly, but clearly they each wanted credit for the wins and for the Super Bowls.
Well, who deserved the most credit out of those two?
Well, I truly believe this. It was one of those rare partnerships. And I always look at the Beatles, right? Big music fan. They were not, George Harrison was not the best guitar player in the world. Paul McCartney was not the best bass player. Go on and on. Ringo Starr wasn't the best drummer. But those four guys together did something that was magical. And when they split up, well, they all did good work. They never did the work that they did while they were together. So I really see that union of Jimmy and Jerry just being a perfect storm. And I think they both had something to prove. Jerry was viewed as this hit coming in from Arkansas, taking over the Cowboys. He fired Tom Landry. Jimmy Johnson was a college coach. And what's interesting, too, you look at this weekend through the Cowboys lens, okay, which is kind of what I do as the Cowboys broadcaster. Who would have thought the three guys going in from the Cowboys organization, right? Drew Pearson, Cliff Harris, and Jimmy Johnson. At the start, Drew in 1970 went undrafted in a draft that had 17 rounds. Wow. Cliff Harris went undrafted in 1973, again in a draft that had 17 rounds. And Jimmy's first year, he goes 1-15. So if anybody, after looking at those guys through a training camp, or their first year in professional football, pointed at him and said, "Hey, there walks a Hall of Famer." you would have been laughed at, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But here they are. I actually asked Mike McCarthy that question this past week. I was in Cowboys camp at Oxnard, California, where they train. And I said, "Hey, these two players were both undrafted free agents." I said, "When you look out at the field here, when you go out to practice today, can you point out a free agent and say, there's a Hall of Famer?"
Let alone two of them. Yeah.
Well, my goodness, it's just crazy. And it almost goes to, you wonder, how the hell did Gil Brandt get into the Hall of Fame when he was a guy in charge and he drafted neither of those players?
We're talking to Babe Laufenberg, 26 years working with the Cowboys Radio Network as a color analyst, former NFL quarterback. Speaking of which, your biggest concern for Dak Prescott this year is what?
Just stay healthy. And obviously he has a shoulder injury, a strain in training camp. I'm not concerned because they're not concerned, truly. I know many times they send up a smoke screen of non-concern about different injuries, and then you find out the guy's out for the year. That won't happen in this case. I mean, he has so many weapons. CeeDee Lamb is going to be just a great player in this league. He had a really, really good rookie season, caught 74 balls. But this is going to be a big-time player. You've got Amari Cooper, Michael Gallup. You got Zeke Elliott, who I think, much like Mark Twain, reports of his death have been greatly exaggerated. He's a heck of a back, and he came to camp. He weighed 218, which is lighter than he's ever been. Maybe a little too light, quite honestly, in my book, because he's a big, powerful man.
But what about the defense, though?
Put some points up. Yeah, they were literally historically bad last year. I always like the Bob Dylan line, just when you think things have gotten as bad as they can, they get a little worse. And so people say, well, it can't be as bad as last year. And I always say, well, why not? There's no rule that says, okay, if you were really, really bad, you will not be worse. But they did try to address it, obviously, in the draft. First six draft picks were on defense. And so they should be better. It appears they brought in some pretty good veteran guys that are going to shore things up a little bit. They should be better. But there are no guarantees, as you well know. But I do think this, the offense is going to carry this team. If the defense can just be average, they're going to win a lot of games.
Well, it's like the Kansas City Chiefs created this model that they're just going to score all these points, and then you just ask your defense to come up with a couple of big stops. And that's what they did in the Super Bowl they won. Chris Jones came up with a couple of big plays. And that's it. I mean, you can score in the NFL, but everybody scores. Really what separates it, feels like, Babe, is the team that does. You know, Tampa won the Super Bowl because of their defense, not because of their offense.
Well, I'll say this. So now the last five Super Bowl winners have all had top five scoring offenses. So you've got to be able to score points in today's NFL. And obviously they make it easy for you to score. I don't want to say easy. It wouldn't be easy if I was out there, but they've made it a lot easier that, the days of, winning games 13-6, those are gone. So you got to be able to score points. I even saw Nick Saban, was listening to him, and he talked about the fact that the one year they gave up 9.9 points a game. They allowed 63 rushing yards a game. He said, I was always play defense, run the ball. And he said once they started throwing around, they started winning more games and winning by bigger margins. So if Nick Saban can change his philosophy, if you will, now obviously he still wants to play defense, and they've got about 10 first-rounders over there this year probably to do it with. But, it's just that's just the way the game has evolved and become. And, again, a lot of the rule changes, as we well know, are all geared to offense. And you're keeping quarterbacks around longer because you can't hit them. Ben Roethlisberger tonight, I mean, he won't play tonight, but, 18 years in the league and thinking about playing next year. So we see the longevity of these guys really lasting because they're not taking the beating that they once did.
Before I let you go, when you were at Stanford and you got there, I think, the year before John Elway. So Elway comes in.
Correct.
When did you know your days were numbered as a quarterback at Stanford when Elway showed up?
I think it was the second half hour of the first practice when he got there.
And so half hour was okay. It was the second half hour.
I was competing. Yeah, but all we did then was stretch. We were doing some stretching and some drills. And actually, interestingly enough, I played against John Elway in high school, so I knew how good he was. And, of course, you think you're going to compete, but But yeah, he was pretty good. And the one good thing about that, Dan, when I left Stanford, of course, immediately people think, oh, you flunked out. I said, no. But I always tell people, look, if I was smart enough to get into Stanford, I was also smart enough to know when to leave. And when Elway showed up, I said, you know, this doesn't look so good for the Bambino here.
How would you describe him for those who didn't see him when he came in at 18, 19 years of age?
He had the same arm that you saw as an NFL player. And again, I actually saw it in high school. What I think is funny is some of these guys have really smooth motions, right? And the ball just kind of said, wow, where do they generate that power? Every time he threw, I swear it looked like he was going to tear his rotator cuff. You can just picture him, can't you?
Yeah.
In the pocket, on his toes, chin up, and then he just ripped the ball. But never forget, too, like two practices in, a guy ran a hook route at about 12 yards and literally just tore the receiver's finger straight off, straight back, bone out.
Oh, wow.
At first I thought, you know, guys really like to catch my ball when I was there and we were competing at Stanford there. And then I realized, you know what, they really just don't like to catch John's because it comes in about 100 miles an hour. Mine, you know, I always like it when they say this guy throws a catchable ball. It means he's got a weak arm, right? And many times the problem is it's catchable for the defense just as easily as for the offense.
Have fun tonight, babe. I'd love to check in with you during the season, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. My pleasure. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live on the Peacock app.
Hey, this is Jason McIntyre. Join me every weekday morning on my podcast, Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre. This isn't your typical sports pod pushing the same tired narratives down your throat every day. Straight Fire gives you honest opinions on all the biggest sports headlines, accurate stats to help you win big at the sports book, and all the best guests. Do yourself a favor and listen to Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's bring in the Hall of Famer, Charlie Steiner, 17 seasons as the Dodgers play-by-play voice on AM 570 LA Sports. Chaz, good to have you back. What was the atmosphere like there the last two nights?
It was fun. It was electric. The first game, the fans were angry. I mean, there was an open hostility. And then when they got down 3-0 and we had more inflatable trash cans than I'd ever seen in my life, and we had, usually when there's a home run, a ball is thrown back onto the field. There were foul balls that were thrown back onto the field. So the first game, it was a little bit dicey. Last night, for a change, it was in fact the players and their bats that did most of the talking. So both of the nights were dramatic and theatrical. Last night in Hollywood, where they always strive for a happy ending, at long last there was.
But also, I wonder if winning a World Series has diffused this just a little bit for Dodger fans.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
But it was fascinating because one of the beauties of working at Dodger Stadium, it's a home field advantage. It's, you know, a visually spectacular ballpark. The sun sets, the San Gabriel Mountains are off in the distance, and you have 52,000 each of the first two nights. The first night, there was this air of trepidation. And after being shut out in the first game, last night, Max Scherzer shows up, have gun, will travel. He might have been Paladin. And the way he came out and did his business, the Dodgers were in desperate need of a win. They were feeling awful about the previous night. And then there was this sense of, okay, now it's the players' turn to speak their vengeance. And they did so with their bats. And the crowd was a little, well, I can't say subdued, a little more gentlemanly last night than they were in the first night. But there were two terrific theatrical games between two terrific teams who, of course, met in the World Series in 17. So it was great, great theater. And Scherzer just turned in one of those performances so that you, if you ever needed reminding of how great this guy is and how he is able to withstand and even embrace the pressure of the moment. It was a brilliant athletic theatrical production last night.
How do you think history will treat the Astros?
Not well. I think at the end of the day, they will always have that scarlet letter. And in this town now, I don't know if it's 1 and 1A or they're just tied for first between Altuve and Carrasco. The boos were genuine. They were visceral. The other guys, they were politely booed because they're the other team. But those two guys, they really got it. And last night when Scherzer began the game by striking out Altuve, arch enemy number one out here, the place went crackers.
Yeah.
And that was the scene, that was the feel, that was the vibe throughout the night. So it was great, great theater.
What are the Dodgers' issues right now?
They have to figure out when Kershaw gets back. They have to solidify their bullpen some. You know, they still haven't gotten Trey Turner to arrive as yet. But last night, for instance, Dan, Scherzer comes back after his spectacular performance. And it was, you know, it was hotel quality, as Kenny would say. He comes back to the dugout, and he is greeted by Clayton Kershaw, Mookie Betts, Albert Pujols. I mean, it was a star-studded attraction greeting him. And in all the years I've been doing it, and I've been working with Rick Monday now for 17 years, we were talking about, I had never seen a pitcher receive a curtain call. Usually when he is finished, he goes into the dugout, gets his high fives, goes about his business. Last night, it was a curtain call, and he was pushed out by whoever. Oh, it just happened to be Clayton Kershaw. It was one of those magical moments. I swear, I don't ever remember a pitcher after a performance, after coming out of the game, then getting a curtain call. So it really was a magical, electric, charismatic moment last night.
What can you sum up what's going on with Cody Bellinger?
No. he really is lost. You know, he's still getting over a shoulder issue. And so that may be part of it. But right now, he is in one of those slumps nobody ever wants to be in. He's dead last for anybody who's got at least 200 at-bats. He's hitting a .160-something. And, you know, it's been a soft .160-something.
Wow.
You know, how this is eventually going to play out, don't know. But one of the things about Bellinger, he may not be hitting much, but he's still as good a defender in center field, right field, or first base as there is. So he does bring a palpable strength to the club. Right now, it just isn't with his bat.
It's great to catch up with you, Charlie. Hope you're well.
I'm doing great. You know, they still haven't caught up to me, and apparently haven't caught up to you either.
Somebody asked about the Andrew Shue SportsCenter commercial where we traded you from SportsCenter to Melrose Place.
Yep. I ask you this one question. Yeah. Where is he now? How'd that trade work out?
I like it. I like that. Where did you shoot that commercial where you're the pool boy?
We flew out to California. We flew out onto the set. And when we did, I don't know, it was 1990-ish, and Melrose Place was a big deal. And I remember getting out there, and the women on the set had no idea who the hell I was. They had no clue. The guys, all they wanted to do was talk sports. And then they put me in that getup, and it was the first and only time I had a schmata on my head. I had, my arms, and I'm Bobby the F pool boy. And I had no idea it would turn out the way it did. We actually went on site to do a SportsCenter commercial. That's how long ago and how much fun it was ago.
And people forget when we first started, And I remember going to John Walsh, who was our boss, and I said, why don't we promote SportsCenter? We promote every other show. We don't promote SportsCenter. He goes, well, we don't have to. And he said, you know, let me see. And then he brought in Wieden and Kennedy, and then they followed us around. And then Wieden and Kennedy people, who were the geniuses behind it, said, hey, we can't get any athletes because we don't pay for anybody to do these commercials. And I reached out to Grant Hill and Jason Kidd. And I said, look, you don't get paid, but you get your own commercial. And Grant Hill played the piano in the lobby. Sure. Jason Kidd came in a helicopter to drop off his highlight tape while he's in his Mavs uniform. After that, everybody wanted their commercial. And, you know, we were forever indebted to Grant Hill and Jason Kidd. Did you have one of those? Was there one other moment that stood out as far as doing those with you?
Well, for me, I guess the one that still has legs and it's crazy. It's now, what, 30 years almost. Follow Me to Freedom.
The Y2K? You know,
the Y2K. And I guess Evander, come looking for me. Come get your whooping. The worst part, when that spot first came out, you know, again, you and I were at a time when we didn't know or realize ESPN was about to become what it would eventually become. Then all of a sudden, these commercials took place. I'd be walking through an airport, and I'd have like some seven-year-old kid come up to me. He'd be all excited and said, come get your whooping, you know, and it's like, come on. And that's when I realized these commercials were onto something. Well, yeah, look, you and I and all of us who were there then going through that evolution, bordering on revolution, ESPN plopping onto the scene. And then those spots. The irony was, as you recall, we used to have nice Christmas parties where a couple of hundred people would show up and everybody knew one another. And by the end of the time, we would go to our own parties and we have no idea who they were, who were there, and they wanted autographs from
them. Yeah.
And at this one party, Steve Bornstein is, and it's late at night, so picture the ambiance.
ESPN president, Steve Bornstein.
Yes. And we were all sufficiently liquored up at 2 in the morning. And Bornstein says to me, the late John Saunders, and Boomer, he said, in a perfect world, SportsCenter would be anchored by monkeys and clowns, and all we really need is the ESPN logo behind us. And then he says, after another belt of some hooch, he points at me and Saunders and Boomer, and he said, but you, and you have screwed up our plan. And within several weeks, you know, everybody had this notion of maybe we can do something to promote us. And again, they were trying to submerge our personalities initially. Now all of a sudden the commercials come out and it changed only everything.
Well, Steve Bornstein is the author of the famous quote where he called me at lunch while he wanted me to sign an extension. You're just bleeping talent, using the F word. So we're having lunch and he says, you're just bleeping talent.
And well, that's a good opening gambit.
Yeah. Yeah. And hey, we want you to sign an extension. Okay. So make up your mind. I'm just effing talent, or hey, we want you to stay for a little while. And well, I signed the extension.
Yeah. I had 14 years there. How many do you have?
18.
All right.
Yeah.
So look, it was a great run while it was, and here we are. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about the other night, Dan, watching Kenny and Rich doing the Olympic stuff on Peacock, it was like a SportsCenter reunion, you know, SportsCenter 20 years later. And I got to tell you, I don't know about you, I felt so proud, especially with Mike, who's anchoring the whole shooting match, Kenny being Kenny and Rich being Rich. It reminded me of how good we were then.
A lot of talent.
How good they are now.
Yeah, a lot of talent. And Tirico came in, he was just a kid. And they were like, yeah, get in line. And
Kenny was the guy who was covering Tonya Harding in Seattle. And it's like, well, so we brought them in. And hell, they brought me in. I had no television talent. But somehow they put this thing together. And for all the years you've been doing, all the years I've been doing what I'm doing, in that heyday, that was about as much fun as I ever had in my career. I mean, there we were, Ice Station Zebra, AKA Bristol, just doing what we did and did it reasonably well, and left very little blood on the floor.
It's good to catch up with you, Charlie, and thanks for joining us as always.
Dan, good to see you.